My name is Lynn Messner, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Lynn.
Wow, this is really cool. I hate to admit this, but I've never been here before. And after this last few minutes, I'm really sorry. I will. Thank you. First of all, I just want to say to the committee, thank you for asking me. I'm really honored and quite humbled to be doing this, to tell you the truth. But I know that all I have is my story and my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm just another drunk in AA. So hopefully I'll have something to share that others can relate to. But thank you. That was so fabulous. I just want to sit there and like, let's just keep singing and clapping. And I was getting nervous after I got here and I sat down and started letting my ego take over, you know, and thinking I need to say all the right things and all the right ways. And, you know, when y'all stood up, well, as soon as it started, really, I felt such an enthusiasm, you know, such a spirit in this room. I just got better so much faster. And then when you started singing, that y'all are fabulous. That choir was wonderful. And I told my friend Gwen, I said, I really do feel relaxed and this is wonderful. But I felt like crying, you know, the tears of when you're so full and you feel such excitement, you know. I thought, well, that's a good way to start your talk. Just start crying. But I do. That really filled me up. It is. It's really awesome. And it got me off to a great start. That's really cool. Really cool. And I'm just going to share with you today what my experience is and tell you a little bit about myself. And what I was like, and oh, good pictures. Pictures, microphone. I told Gwen, I said, I wish we'd walk in and we're just all sitting around tables and, you know, in a circle like we do in meetings. Somehow it's a little easier to share that way, but of course, all I have is the same thing to share, whether I'm standing or sitting. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today and as it relates to the steps. Gwen and I were talking this week because I love the way that's put, you know, the magic and the power of the steps, but we were talking about the magic and what that means and started looking up in the dictionary and I wrote down two things about magic. It says something that seems to cast a spell. And I thought, you know, that's really appropriate. If you looked at me, like, drinking and then look at me today, it looks like I'm under a different spell, you know, because I look so different, sound so different. And the other is an extraordinary power or influence seemingly from a supernatural source. Well, that applies, doesn't it? And, you know, and that's what happens because sometimes today I don't really understand necessarily how it works. You know, you ever have those days where you're kind of responding differently to life and different things are happening and you go, wow, you know, and you don't really understand it, but you know it's just something greater than yourself. And sometimes what I really believe, because I have my moments in my days where I don't feel that real specific, focused, spiritual connection, me and God, I seem to always feel it in AA, and especially with women, and in meetings, one-on-one, you know, and I feel that connection, I feel that power there. So, man, you know, I only recognized a couple of people when I walked in this room this morning, and, you know, it's like there is a magic here, because now I feel like I know you, you know? So that's really neat, and I don't know that I ever went anywhere that I could get that. My sobriety date is March 24th, 1982. I just celebrated my 16th AA birthday. Thank you. I should say thank you, God. Thank you, women of AA, and, you know, and the fellowship and the steps. I know that's what's worked in my life. I came to AA too young, and it really seems young today, 16 years later. I was 27 years old, and I'd been drinking for 10 years. I'd been drinking daily for 5, Am I echoing, or is that just me?
No, you're not.
Should I do something different here?
Okay.
Sorry. I should have adjusted. Okay.
Uh-oh.
You want me to come closer?
I don't know what to do about it.
Try not to be intimidated. Okay.
Bend down and do it.
Can you hear me? Okay.
And I had been drinking at least for 5 years on a daily basis. And, you know, if you looked at my background and my home life growing up, you know, I didn't really have the setting to become an alcoholic. I don't come from an alcoholic background. As a matter of fact, today I'm the only admitted alcoholic in my family, and the only one in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we've had a few show up here and there since I've been sober, but I'm the only one in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can't tell you, you know, a background of a lot about alcoholism when I grew up. But I think this is just my point of view, that I was born with fertile ground to be alcoholic. To describe myself, I was since I can ever remember, I was this kid with insecurities, fears, inadequacies, a great need to fit in and be a part of, but not feeling like I did. And I went to a lot of different ways to do that in growing up. But, you know, it's such, you know, today was another example of when you walk in and you don't know. And then just to be here for a minute and to have all that and go, God, I really do belong here. You know, I really do fit in. And that's the truth. I don't know that I have had that feeling of fitting in anywhere else other than Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just really a neat thing. So, I grew up, I'm a native of Atlanta. My family moved around quite a bit when I was younger, but I'm a native and I've been here back in Atlanta since 1974. But when I had my first drink, and I just want to tell you a little bit about my first drink, which was my first drunk, which was my first pass out, my first blackout, my first throw up, you know, just like, you know, if somebody's looking down and going, ooh, those are pretty good signs that she could have a problem, on my very first taste of alcohol. I was 17, almost 17, and I really looked like the good little girl, kind of a goody two-shoes, as a matter of fact, through a lot of my school and growing up, because I was afraid of not fitting in. I went to my high school reunion one year, and one of the guys said, you know, you were like a closet derelict. You know, I was really a derelict, liked a lot of things that I wasn't supposed to do, but I really didn't want certain people to know. So I had, you know, like two separate lives, but that's kind of what I was like. But my first drunk was, as I'm 17 years old, I had a blind date with a college friend of my brother's, and I was going with my girlfriend, and they were older, and he introduced me to a few ready-made drinks, and what I remember most that's really significant to me is that I remember before they picked us up, I was just this nervous, awkward, scared, ugly, you know, so concerned with what I was going to say, what I was going to look like, what I was going to wear, you know, just totally self-consumed, which I can be today. But that night I thought, oh, God, this is just, I was just a nervous wreck. So I remember when we had the first couple of drinks, and I believe today that's what my subconscious always sought out after that, is that we had a few drinks, he had a pilot's license. I always thought that added to my drunk. We had a pilot's license, went flying, you know, and then came back down and thought that made my drunk worse, but nothing to do with the alcohol, just the flying, you know. But we went to a bar. He had these false IDs, went in the bar, and I remember them serving, you know, this is after a couple drinks, and I remember them serving these great big flaming drinks and tall red things and sitting on this guy's lap thinking, he is so lucky to be with me. I mean, I remember that thought of, like, I could talk, I looked better, and I was a great date, you know? So I believe in my subconscious, that's what I always looked for after that, is that feeling of I'm okay, I'm comfortable, you know, and that I fit in. Now, we'll tell you the end of that date was that I passed out, threw up in his car. He had to carry me in the house, and he didn't ask me out again. Imagine that. So, some date. But that was my first experience. I mean, I woke up, I came to, I should say, like 4 o'clock in the morning, standing in my room. My girlfriend's passed out on my bed. I'm going, what happened? I mean, it was really a frightening thing. It was like the last thing I remember, it had been 10 o'clock. So, you know, I had this whole blackout that other people had to, you know, fill in for me. I wasn't even quite 17 years old and goody two shoes and thinking, I will never do this again, you know. But I believe as an alcoholic that just stuck with me, you know, that from then on I just kept trying to seek out what that was. When I got into college a couple years later, I thought of myself as a social drinker, and I can remember getting to college and sipping beer and, you know, just to be social. And I remember that night, oh, it just stuck. I loved beer. I mean, I was a beer lover, and it became my staple from then on. If somebody was from the outside looking in, it didn't look like that alcohol interfered in my life for two or three years. I mean, I managed to finish school and to get a job, but it seemed like once that sort of restraint was gone about finishing school and so forth, and I maintained, I got this job traveling. Didn't know what the heck I was doing. But, you know, I did a lot of that where I just, like, somebody offered, I say yes. You know, I don't know why. You know, I never had a plan for my life. You know, I never thought about, you know, thinking something through, making a decision. You know, the idea of think about it, talk about it, pray about it, write about it never was part of my life then. And so I took a job, and I think it was a perfect job for the alcoholic, for the fertile ground, because it was a lot of freedom. I could, you know, drink when I wanted to. I was on my own, and I wasn't clocking in and out. And anyway, that path just, for me, led me to wonderful drinking. And so for the next few years, those 5 years, I began, and it amazes me today, it was probably only 5 or 6 years of daily drinking. And when I think back about it, at 26 years old, barely 27, I couldn't imagine that I could drink like that for another year or 5 years. I mean, I really believe today in my heart that I would be dead because of the way I was drinking. And in those 5 years, what happened is the alcohol became the most important thing in my life. I couldn't maintain any relationships, couldn't maintain a job. I couldn't maintain working at a job. I started waking up in strange places with strange people that I didn't always know that I had made that decision to. Did you ever notice that in alcohol, that you've never made decisions, you know? I had a girlfriend when we first got sober, we used to say, God, we'd wake up and go, oops. And you notice how in sobriety you can't go, oops. We're conscious and aware. But anyway, and I would wake up the next day going, who is that person? You know, what happened? And because I remember an example of when I graduated from college, thinking, you get a job and you find the right person to settle down with and have a future and you enjoy working. I mean, I sort of had an idea of a stable, move forward kind of future. But, you know, for me, alcohol just took over my life. I had no God consciousness. I come from a background of, I was raised a Southern Baptist, and I didn't have a lot of blinders or, you know, real strong negative things about God. It just wasn't a part of my life. There's a lot of things that I did in my drinking that I had guilt, shame, remorse, and I'll tell you what got me to my bottom probably faster than anything was the self-hate. I hated the person I'd become. I hated the things that I had done. I kept looking at going, what is wrong with you? You know, I never could point to I never looked at it like, you know, don't drink and maybe this won't happen. I always looked at it like it becomes such a part of me, the drinking, that it never was an idea of not to. It was an idea of drink something different. Don't drink. I'd become a morning drinker. You know, don't drink in the morning. Wait till 5 o'clock. Try just, you know, the things that our big book talks about. You know, the first step in the big book describes so many of those things that we do. I did, and I did that in those few years. And like I said, I didn't know another alcoholic. I really didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a girlfriend whose father became very ill, and he joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Her mother went to Al-Anon, and I can remember her telling me about that probably about 2 years before I got sober, and said that they're very involved, and they go to meetings all the time. And I went, isn't that a shame that they have to do that? Their life is ruined. So, you know, I didn't have a dramatic or traumatic bottom. I had a job where I was working in South Carolina, and this was another turning point. I mean, when I came to AA and started hearing terms of, you know, geographic cure, I went, oh, is that what I did? And I got this new job at a new place, a new boss, new surrounding. Everything was new, and I thought, this is it. I was 26 years old, and I thought, I have the world by the tail, fresh new start. I'd been unemployed for some months, and, you know, that's why I was drinking in the morning. I had too much time on my hands. I had so many excuses. And what happened for me in my last year or so of drinking is I became a solo drinker. I enjoyed drinking alone, late night drinking. My friend Gwen and I talk about that. I mean, I don't know why that sounds like so much fun today, but there was something about creating my own world, late night, nobody to bother you, nobody to look at the bottle, nobody to question. And there was just something really, you know, neat about that, I thought. But what happened was that I stopped functioning. And I remember the day that I just made a conscious decision. I used to try to maybe drink for a few days and then try to do my job and then try to sober up and try to do that on my own, drink a few. I never went without drinking, but I try to just control it so that I can get the job done. And I can remember one Monday morning, so I'm just not going to try anymore. And I just started drinking around the clock. I'd drink, pass out, wake up, drink, you know, just that kind of cycle. And then pretty soon there are some people that look for you, like your boss and your mother. And I didn't answer the phone. I love the little things that we can share that we can relate to, and I share this, and I remember one time when somebody said, oh God, I did that, and it just makes you feel so connected. But I didn't have an answering machine back then, but it was like I lived in this basement apartment too. It was so cool when you wanted to just like really just dark drinking, you know, you could shut the blinds, and I not only took the phone off the hook, I hid the phones. Like, so I wouldn't know that there was any communication in the outside world. And, you know, I tell you this, I think it's hilarious today because I'm married and my husband would tell you now, that phone is connected to my ear half the days that I'm, you know, the hours that I'm home. And it's mostly with Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I just think that's hilarious today to think about what I was like. I didn't want any connection, didn't want to talk to anybody, just wanted to hide from people. I didn't know why I couldn't function in this world. I didn't know why. I mean, I really didn't look at the drinking. It was more like, I'm drinking because I'm depressed, because I can't handle it. You know, this isn't happening because I'm drinking. So what happened was that the police came, and they said, you must call home. And when the police are at your door, I said, okay, so came back to Atlanta. My brother came to get me, came back to Atlanta, and that was the beginning of the end for me. It wasn't real traumatic, but I came back to Atlanta, and I moved in with my parents, and it was kind of a hush-hush thing, you know, like, Lynn has problems. But nobody knew how to talk about it, so we sort of whispered. And maybe she's depressed. But my mother, bless her heart, she knew, and she could see it. I wasn't always the drunk that, I did do this a lot, but I could sometimes drink, and I've seen other drunks today do this, but where you have that glazed look, and you're not all there, and you're not really focused, but you're sort of walking and maintaining. I was like that almost all the time. Because I'd get up and drink, and it was really hard to maintain at home when you're living on your parents' roof. And I would try to do that and then try to maintain. It was so much work. But, you know, my mother saw that. And one day she came home and she said, "You've been drinking." And I went, "Well, you know, I did have a couple before you got here, starting at 7 a.m. this morning." But she said, "Man, this is just remarkable to me. You talk about the power and the magic. It started working before I knew it." She said, "Would you go to a meeting with me?" And we had never discussed this. And I said, "Oh, no." And I knew she wanted to take me to AA. And I found out she had been going to Al-Anon. And so I said, "Oh, no, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and I just won't be one." And do you know that's all? Here I am. And today, proud of it, just telling everybody. But and that's a line in our big book, you know, that talks about, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You know, I didn't know I was speaking such truth. So, but being the good house and being in her house, I said, "Well, I'll go." And I did go to my first meeting, and I love this because, you know, it's good for me to remember today. I don't know if y'all are ever in meetings where there's a newcomer, and I get that feeling that, like, okay, let's all say just the right thing, you know, just, you know, so they'll connect and relate, you know. We know it doesn't matter because that power and that magic is here from just us being here and sharing our truth. Because I went to that meeting, and I can tell you that night my experience was they were all old men staring at me. And this one woman, and they were talking, I do remember what they talked about. It was anonymity, which I was thrilled. You know, let's don't ever know anybody or say your names or anything, you know. And I was so embarrassed, so I liked that topic. I thought, well, let's all keep our mouth shut about it. But I had this woman come up to me afterwards, and she gave me some literature, and she gave me one of those silly white chips and said, "When was your last drink?" And I said, "Well, let's see. I think I had a drink on Sunday while we were watching the ball game." Yeah. Now, it had been a long time since I went a day, a couple hours without a drink. Truly, at this time, I was drinking as much as I could and try to maintain. And that's an amazing thing to me about, you know, just talking and relating about some of the steps is that that powerlessness. I had moments where I could and looked like I was maintaining. And then there were times I could have one drink, I'd be in a blackout, or I'd be passed out. Or I could, you know, and so the powerlessness to me was just, and also I was thinking of that moment too, the powerlessness of feeling like I had to lie all the time. I mean, it wasn't a conscious decision when you're drinking like that. I felt like I was just lying all the time. I lived a lie. So, you know, I certainly wasn't in any place to tell her the truth. And she said, "Will you just carry this white chip and make today your first day?" I'm sure I was, like, reeking on her. And what I remember that I think is so important is the seeds were planted then. I had the literature. I had this wonderful woman come up that looked like she cared. I knew who to call when I was ready. And 6 months later, I was ready. And nothing traumatic happened except for what had happened in South Carolina. One day, because I'd come back to Atlanta, back with family, back with the old boyfriend, got a job with a boss I knew. See, in South Carolina, everything was new. It was so overwhelming. I didn't know anybody. You know, all those excuses. Went from this is the new beginning to, well, this is the reason I can't handle it. It's all too new, you know. And that, I'll tell you what, from the time that I got there to the time I made that decision of not trying anymore, it was 90 days. I'm not talking about 6 months or a year. I mean, 90 days I wasn't functioning. So when I came back to Atlanta, and this is just my story, and this is, you know, how I hit bottom, I came back to Atlanta, I thought, well, this is it. Come back, get back into being a part of my family, a job I knew, a field I knew, boss I knew. And like I said, it was just a miracle that I even got that job. And back with the old boyfriend. And I thought, well, this will be okay. Now I can do this. And 6 months later, I did the exact same thing that I did in South Carolina. Just made a decision. I don't know why. Don't understand it. But I can't seem to maintain and live in this world. like what other people look like. Other people look like they get up, they have breakfast, they go to work, you know, they have families, they move forward in their life, they have like checking accounts, you know, where they write their check down and pay their bills. I mean, other people look like they're doing that, and I don't know why, I just couldn't seem to be a responsible, participating human being in this world. But you know what? When I picked up that drink, that's where the unpredictability came, and I never not picked up the drink. So the same thing happened, made a decision, couldn't handle it, just started drinking around the clock. This time my father came to get me. I was staying at my brother's apartment, and he came and he said, you're drinking. And I will say this, that there wasn't a specific moment where I, you know, started drinking because, you know, it was just a turning point. I was drinking when people say, I mean, really seeking that feeling, you know, where I wanted to just, I used to say just to take the edge off. Took a lot of edges off, but you know, where you could just kind of get that cool, calm feeling, glow. I mean, that's what I was really seeking at this point, you know. What started out 10 years ago of being sociable, fitting in, being a part of, really ended up just me and the bottle and trying to get that feeling so I could basically block out the rest. And when he came and I said, he didn't even say the word alcoholic, and I just said, oh, I just can't be an alcoholic, and this is great. The stigma to the family. Now, I haven't had a shower in days. Haven't eaten, just been drinking, smoking cigarettes, just, you know, that's it, on the couch. And I must have looked horrible, especially I think about parents and children and how painful that must be, you know, and I think about him looking at his daughter and going, this is scary. And he said the words that rang my bell. He said, being alcoholic is not the problem. He said, not doing anything about it is the problem. And, I mean, that didn't even come from the big book, and it worked. and I said, I'll be home tomorrow. And the next day, I called central office, tried to act like I was okay. Do you need anybody to pick you up? Why would I need that? No. And this time, she gave me directions. I was living in Clarkston. She gave me directions to the Clarkston 12-step group, which is my home group. Yay! And it's my home group today. And I went, and wouldn't you know it, I made the call. I was getting ready, and I go, and there was just a small group. It was a women's group. And I walked in, and there were no old men staring at me. They were all women. Half of them were my age or younger. And I'll tell you what my first experience was, and that is they're laughing. They're smiling. And they're saying they're alcoholic. I mean, what in the world is wrong with that? Because I thought, okay, I have a problem. This is my cross to bear. I hate it. Can't imagine. Now, I will tell you that I took a beer to my first meeting, not inside, but I was so nervous and I had the shakes and I had the worst hangover I could ever remember having. And I stopped and I thought, well, I'll just chug this beer. And I chugged half the beer. And again, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, because this makes me, again, know, every time I think of it, that we don't have to worry about what's said or done in the meetings as much as just being there and being truthful. God will do the rest. Because I put the beer in the car and my thought was, now they told me this meeting was only an hour long. My beer will still be cold when I get out. And I walked in the meeting, women, young, laughing, looked happy, said they're alcoholic. I heard some things. They shared about not drinking, having a life. And when it came to me, you know, how we do, especially a smaller group where they all look at you. Would you like to share? And I said, and I had no intentions of this, and this is, to me, the magical part. My name is Lynn, and I'm an alcoholic. And just my experience was there was a great relief. And it's all your fault. You made me emotional today. I feel like crying. And that was a great power, and that was a great relief. And the beer that was in my car, that was my last drink. I walked out. Now, I will tell you that I was too afraid to touch the beer. I had somebody help me pour it out the next day. Isn't that weird? But the fear of alcohol had been instilled already. And that was my last drink. And I think that's really powerful that I thought about, that wasn't my thought going into the meeting and when I came out, that was it. I was told at that first meeting to not pick up the drink no matter what that night and come back tomorrow. And I'm still doing that. I mean, hey, isn't that neat? Still work. That still works, and I really try to keep it somewhat that simple today about my recovery and my sobriety. I was told 90 meetings in 90 days. I was told get a sponsor. The sponsor I chose is the same sponsor I have today. Now, I think this is really remarkable when I think about myself and my, you know, experience of not being able to stay with jobs, not being able to maintain anything, I have the same sponsor after 16 years. I have the same home group after 16 years. I've lived in the same place for almost 13 years, and I've had the same job for over 11 years. Now, that's pretty magical when I think about it. So I started my path of recovery and started the path of these steps. And I have a sponsor. At the time, she was single, had a lot of time. I looked at her, and she looked in the middle of the AA bed. And I just followed her around like a shadow. And she worked the steps. She had a lot of sponsorees. And I just followed her around like she was my mother. And in some ways, you know, she felt like my higher power at that time, you know, before I had that individual consciousness and spiritual connection. I got it through her. And she walked me through the steps. And I don't know if y'all remember, like, seeing the steps on the wall or hearing it for the first time. And I honestly thought that meant that you just read them, you know, like we did today, just out loud, you know, just read them. And I really had no idea what that meant, you know. Thank goodness. I don't know about y'all, if you knew like what you were going to actually have to do at the beginning, you know, thank goodness it is a day at a time, you know, and that things are, they unfold and they're revealed, at least for me, pretty much, and I wouldn't say comfortable way, but, you know, in a gradual way. And that has been a lot about my sobriety. It's a lot about the drunk that I am, you know, the garden variety, that things have come slowly and gradually and my progress has been slow. I was fired from a job at 9 months sober. I thought you stop drinking and I'd just be fine, you know. And still had a hard time just showing up working every day. Imagine that. So I learned very quickly that there were some things that I needed to change in my attitude and in my actions to become a participating member of society. And so I lost that job, and someone from AA gave me a job where I had to clock in, clock out, have a 30-minute lunch hour, you know, some very well-defined rules and guidelines for me, which was exactly what I needed. It kept me off the road traveling and drinking in hotels. It was a perfect setting. I could go to meetings, and I went to a lot of meetings. The first 30 days, I didn't quite catch on to going to meetings, but after I'd white-knuckled it for a couple of weeks, and a guy said to me, I thought you'd gotten drunk. I thought, I'll show him. Whatever works. And I did. I started coming to meetings, and I started being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and when I think about what happened in that meeting, I feel like even before I knew it was getting a connection. And that even though my thought was, well, I'll just show up here and I won't like it and, you know, come late, leave early, that kind of thing. And certainly we don't talk to each other and see each other outside of these rooms, do we? And, you know, and I can tell you today, Alcoholics Anonymous is the most and largest part of my life. It is my foundation. You know, it is my life. And I know that everything that I have, the way that I feel internally, externally, comes from being sober, being part of Alcoholics Anonymous, having a home group, having a place that I can be of service, sharing with others. You know, my sponsor was a great example because we didn't waste time on steps. You know, like we didn't have a time frame of give yourself a year before you were. You know, we just got involved, and part of that doing the steps and working the steps to me was so I could feel a part of. You know, I'm at a home group where we have a lot of step meetings, and Clarkston has about 40 meetings a week, and we have, I was trying to count them the other day, at least 10 or 12 that are step meetings or tradition meetings. So it might be more than that now, but you're there, you know, you're in the steps, and then after a while you go, well, maybe I should be doing something more. You know, they're talking about it all the time, and I did. You know, I have to admit that I did my first inventory just so I could say I did it. And that's kind of magical, too. What do you think? I didn't really mean to get this involved, you know. And I laugh about it. My sponsor and I were talking about it the other day. I was telling her that I was coming here this morning, and I said, you know, I feel pretty humbled, you know, talking about the steps, and, you know, because I am no expert on it. And she said, man, we're all just alcoholic, and you've worked the steps. What else would you have to share? And I said, well, that's true, and it may be different than others, and I don't really think my first inventory would be, you know, a great example of the ideal inventory. I mean, I literally wrote down initials, abbreviations, codes. I mean, that's how fearful I was, and because just writing it, looking at myself, my actions on paper, and so mine was, I have to tell you, mine was garbage. Mine was like getting the garbage out. My guilt, my remorse, my self-hate, I had to put it on paper. And I knew in the starting of it, even though it was difficult for me to write it, I thought, you know, I can't hardly write it. How am I going to say it out loud? But it was my beginning, you know, and I believe that was God doing for me too, that I knew that I was just going to move on. Plus, I had a sponsor that said, we're doing your fifth step on Friday at 10 a.m. Oh, okay, you know. So, quite encouraging. But, you know, one of the things, I should back up because that, another experience that I had is with the first step, when I first came in thinking, you know, saying that I was an alcoholic was really neat and a real relief. I thought that meant something. But coming to understand my powerlessness, I had a light bulb with that not too long after I came in because I was just barely 27. There were some things that had not happened to me yet. I had not gotten a DUI, had not been in a hospital, had not gone to jail. It's funny now, I had my own list back then, you know, I can't even come up with it now, but I had these things that were my list where I wasn't that bad. And then I heard this woman come in who was younger than I, and she sat down and she had her list of why she wasn't that bad or that alcoholic, and I had done everything on her list. So that was my little light bulb. And also to know that the powerlessness for me was the unpredictability of alcohol. That when I picked up the drink, there were times, like I said, that I could be okay. Okay is relative, but, you know, I wasn't throwing up, passing out. No, it doesn't always happen. I mean, I thought the word sober was kind of strange because to me, I was either sober or really drunk, blacking out, passing. I mean, it was... the term didn't make any sense to me, but what I know today is I was never sober for those 5 years, and very few of the 10. So for me, really coming to understand that the powerlessness was it wasn't my choice what happened. It wasn't my choice when I had a few, wasn't my choice when I had a lot. So that was my light bulb. And I remember thinking, you know, if I'm powerless, oh, please, I hope there's something more powerful than this. And I had my first experience that I didn't, when I got in the car that night after that first meeting, it was really my second meeting, but I call it my first because I went on my own, that I didn't pick up that drink. That was my first example of there's something more powerful happening here. I mean, I don't know that I use that word, but more like something's happening, more like the definition of the magic. you know, the unknown, the unexplainable at the time. So what I believe in the second step today is that it is a power greater than me. And today, I don't know about y'all, but I have this alcoholism that really demonstrates itself through my thinking, you know. I may not have the physical part of the compulsion and obsession, which has been removed. I ask God to do that on a daily basis. Thy will be done. I keep it pretty simple. But do you know that alcoholism, I think, is still a part of me, and it comes through with my thinking. So what I do today is I really ask God to help me just with sane thinking. And I do that through prayer, and I do that through sharing with people I know, telling the truth, and that sort of gets me centered. And my experience with the third step is that I had, I was before I got fired from that job I had my first year, I had to go to a meeting, a big meeting where they'd been drinking and all that stuff, and I had just been a couple of months sober, and I was absolutely scared to death. And I remember saying the third step prayer, and I said it over and over and over and over again. You know, like I memorized it within my first 90 days. I thought that was very cool. And it was out of need. And you know how sometimes, again, the power of this, that you look back and see how it worked? Well, that's what happened to me that weekend. You know, I just kept saying that third step prayer over, and people offer you drink. I mean, you know, no thank you. My sponsor said, you can just say no thank you. I just, no thank you. And after the end of the weekend, I knew that I'd said that third step prayer over and over. Didn't know what that meant. It was just asking for God's help at the time. And I thought, this works. And then right after that, I did my inventory. And again, I wasn't like your poster child for inventories, but it was the best I could do at the time, and it got rid of a lot. And my sponsor encouraged me, set up the appointment for the fifth step. And the fifth step for me was very difficult. It was very difficult for me to come from this place of insecurity, and I'd spent so long of trying to look different, sound different, be different, you know, than what I, you know, what you saw here and what I was here was two different things. So it's a hard thing to, our hard habit to break. So being able to not only tell her the garbage and the stuff that I'd done, the things that I was absolutely ashamed of, the things that I did that really kept me drinking, was hard. And I'll tell you, the truth is that I didn't feel great after my fifth step. But the magic was that in about a week or 2 weeks or 30 days, I looked back and I started realizing I was sharing in my meetings more, you know, that I wasn't just keeping it simple, sharing about the day. I was actually sharing about my pain, my fear, my, oh my God. I remember a guy saying to me after a meeting, I never even heard you share that you drank. So what that did for me is, like it says in the big book, you know, that we started feeling connected with the universe. It just didn't happen that very moment. It happened gradually, and that has been definitely my experience. I think 6 and 7 are quite tricky myself, but I believe I have a lot of responsibility, even though it says that we ask God to remove it. I believe my responsibility is getting ready, and for me, getting ready sometimes is like really being in a lot of pain. There's a lot of awareness, there's a lot of recognition, but it's getting in a lot of pain. And throughout my sobriety, there have been a lot of different areas from, and if we had a whole nother morning, I would talk about being single and sober in AA, but we don't have time for that. That brings on a whole nother area. But I was single and sober in AA for seven years, I think, and that was interesting. But just to be general, every area of my life, I had a problem with men, and I just absolutely needed, wanted, desired, compulsion for attention, to be loved. Now, of course, I didn't know what it was to be a part of a relationship, you know, like to do your part, you know, but have had to learn that slowly. But you know, it was like the need, and I believe this completely. You know, when we talk about that hole in the donut, you know, you take away alcohol, there's a hole there that, you know, 3 packs of cigarettes a day couldn't fill, and 10 cups of coffee. I mean, I had, you know, my compulsion showed up in a lot of different ways. So So it has been gradual, you know, and doing inventories on each area of my life and the times that I've hit from finances and jobs and men and relationships and friendships. And so sometimes I feel like I've done 6 and 7, you know, maybe feel this way too, in certain areas. It hasn't been across the board. At the beginning, it was kind of across the board. I just wanted to be whitewashed, you know. God, I'm going to say this prayer, when it all go away, and I'll be rendered white as snow. And it didn't happen. I actually had some of those oops in AA and sober. And so, you know, I always have called them cringers. I had a lot of cringers drinking. I've had cringers sober. I was not rendered white as snow. I didn't follow the path that was always right action, always the right thing, you know. But I've learned through making mistakes. And 6 and 7 to me is a constant, number one, being aware, and a constant asking for God's help and doing my part, you know. 8 and 9, I love this, that I wrote down the, I don't know why I can't always remember the principles behind the steps off the top of my head. I'm always looking at them. But there's two things that have been a lot to me, and that's step 8 and 9, brotherly love and discipline. Two things I didn't have a lot of. And for a long time I didn't understand, you know, what that meant. But it takes a lot of love doing an 8th step and appreciating your fellow man and getting yourself out of the way. I mean, my 8th step, you know, my sponge said, write down exactly what you owe an amends for and why. And my why, I always, you know, I kind of wanted to put in sort of what was done unto me, just so you'll know, be reminded of that, you know. And I still have a hard time with that today, staying on my own side of the street. Now, I think it's really good. I have a sponsor that I can just really dump my stuff on, and I can say, take his inventory, you know, but and then get on my side of the street. But that's what the step is, my side of the street, my responsibility, get rid of the, you know, what I want to blame. And then the discipline has been really hard for me. I mean, my discipline has come, I mean, it's learning how to keep on keeping on, making sure that list is covered in a day at a time and being complete and being thorough. And I have needed discipline in my life for all these years. The discipline of going to work, doing my job, being married, having a home, you know, showing up on time, chairing meetings. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. I didn't know how to do any of those things. And I love 10 when it says perseverance, because discipline and perseverance to me go together. But 10 is just a constant, to me, is just trying to, on a regular basis, being able to admit when I'm wrong, clearing my path, my side of the street. And 11 is great. Now, I always think that somebody else should definitely be talking about step 11, but I'll just be honest with you. I struggle with it because I picture myself what is maybe perfection, or really what you're supposed to do, is step 11 is that you should have this 30 minutes or an hour every single day, quiet, wonderful, perfect meditation. And I'll tell you what works for me is quiet time. And that's what I call it. If I can just get quiet every day and have that God awareness, asking for help, and it's just part of, you know, part of a routine, like I try to eat breakfast now, you know. I used to do Snickers, Cokes, coffee, and cigarettes for the day. And so now I get that out of my life, and I actually have a breakfast and a quiet time. And I try to make that part of my daily thing. It's not always, it doesn't always look even real spiritual, but it is just me asking for God's help and trying to get that connection. And the 12th step has been really important for me. I had a sponsor that was so involved in AA, and she sponsors so many women, and she was such an example and an ideal for me, you know, that getting here and becoming involved and being of service and having a home group and being of service in your home group and reaching out has been really great. And from that, I think, you know, this may be a little backwards, but it's what seems to work for me. And doing that, I think, is how we learn how to practice the principles, you know. Because by myself and on my own, I can look like I practice principles really well by myself. It's when you're out there, you know, in the middle of your home group, in the middle of a business meeting, you know, you know, chairing a meeting and somebody didn't like how you do, you know, just all those kind of things. And that has been my, you know, greatest example of how to practice the principles, is being involved with others. And today, you know, like I mentioned earlier, there's just nothing greater. I never go a day without talking to anywhere from 1 to 5 recovering alcoholics. And now I know, I mean, it's important for me to also to remember that the first call I ever got where somebody called me, I thought, what in the heck are you doing? I'm fine. Why are you calling me? You know, that was at first. And now, you know, I call, they call, and it is that connection. I believe staying sober and Alcoholics Anonymous are some really simple things for me today, and that is I ask for God's help and that I go to meetings. I go to meetings regularly, that I have a sponsor that I talk to and that I share with other recovering alcoholics. It's really simple, and there are a lot of things that come from that that I need to do, but if I do those things, asking for God's help, having a sponsor, sharing honestly, and a part of my home group and going to meetings, then the other answers will come. But I realize where I come from that, you know, from a place of drinking alone by myself, didn't want to tell anybody anything, you know, doing the codes and initials. I can't imagine me, you know, sharing of this and being able to share so much more of myself. And I believe that if there is one of those ingredients missing in my recovery, or that I'm faltering on, you know, my quiet time, or maybe I've missed a meeting, my connection with other women has gotten me back on the path always. You know, I am no spiritual giant. I do not have, you know, a total, honest to God, connection every day. I have moments where I have fears that come over me. I have obstacles. I have doubts. And they can be from the smallest of things to big deals. But when I am connected and sharing with another woman, somehow I feel like I'm on the, you know, I can get in the middle of the road. So that has been, you know, the most important part of me and my sobriety. And looking at, you know, the way that we talk about this as magic and power, that is magical for me. Because I still, after this period of time, sometimes don't know how it works. I mean, do you ever feel like that? Okay, I've just told you this horrible thing about myself, and how is this going to make me feel bad? You know, you look at some of the things that we do and the honesty that we share, and, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm just going through the motions. I'm on my knees. Okay, I did this yesterday and the day before, but, and then you go, I feel better. And for me, it has always been gradual. I've had a couple of, you know, moments where I go, really aware it's happening now, but for the most part, my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and my recovery has been gradual, and the magic has been looking back and going, this really works, and I just don't always know how. But what I know is that I keep showing up, I don't pick up the drink no matter what, and I keep sharing with women like you. I really appreciate you having me here. This has been a great experience for me. Thank you.